This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton, and thank you for joining us today. Yesterday, Main Street convened near one of North Dakota's most important Main Streets. Highway 83 becomes State Street as it passes by the Capitol grounds and the North Dakota Heritage Center in Bismarck. We were there to take part in a media panel for the Good Government Summit supported by ThinkND, the Northern Plains Ethics Institute, the North Dakota Humanities Council, and the Bush Foundation. Clay Jenkinson was there to portray Thomas Jefferson, considering the qualities of good government and leadership. And Merrill Pepcorn offered decoded 8-book essays about people and events that reflected the good government theme. Our media panel included our news director, Dave Thompson, Cecile Wehrman with the Journal Publishing, which publishes papers in Crosby and Tioga, Amy Dalrymple, a reporter with the Bismarck Tribune, Jack Zaleski with the Forum, and Mike Jacobs with the Grand Forks Herald. I started the discussion with a question, and Cecile Wehrman offered the first response.
What has changed about government in North Dakota since you started, Cecile?
Well, I would have started my reporting career in Williston in 1985, and the thing that I always appreciated but didn't realize how special it really was from the get-go was how accessible all of our state officials are. I would like to say that they're all as accessible as they were back then. They aren't quite. But just a brief story about how to illustrate that is Governor Sinner was the governor at the time, and he was so personable to a young reporter who was probably asking pretty dumb questions at that time. But he remembered me as my career went from Williston to Grand Forks. And at the time that I was looking at leaving North Dakota for a time, he offered to write me a letter of recommendation. And when I went to a news station in Kansas a few years later and presented this letter of recommendation from Governor Sinner, they were floored, absolutely floored. And I guess that's just an indication of how open North Dakota state officials are.
And what a spectacular fellow he was. Dave?
Well, just to go along with that comment that you made, I was hosting a person from Washington, D.C. We were down at the old Kirkwood Mall where they had the theaters down there. We were going to see a movie. And we're standing in line, and all of a sudden from the back, he says, "I can't get away from reporters." I turned back, and there's Governor Ellison right behind me. No security, and this guy from Washington, D.C. was absolutely floored that there was no security around the governor. I said, this is what happens all the time in North Dakota. You'd always see Ed Schaefer jog along Riverside Park in Bismarck, and I'd run into him. You know, I'd go to work at 4:30 in the morning. He's out there running at 4:30 in the morning. That was fun. And this is why one of the changes that I've seen, I understand why the change was made, but it just bothers me a little bit in the back, is when you go to the Capitol now, you have to go through metal detectors because of the security issues. And security is a big thing. Why we have the new governor's mansion is going to be a lot about security. So that kind of openness, that just kind of sticks in my craw a little bit. I understand, again, why it's happening. There was one other change that I wanted to just mention very briefly. One of the biggest changes I've seen since I've covered politics, which I've been covering politics since the Dead Sea just become sick, was the fact that House members in the North Dakota legislature went from 2-year to 4-year terms. And that was a huge change, and it changed a lot of dynamics. And I'd be willing to get into that if people have questions.
Jack?
I, too, have been covering North Dakota politics a long time. Mike and I were advisors to Gutenberg.
Martin Luther thanks you.
My story goes to Governor Arthur Link, who I found to be one of the greatest gentlemen and lovers of North Dakota that I have ever had the privilege to meet. I can't remember the issue, but my editor, I was at the Devil's Lake Journal at the time, my editor had assigned me a story in which I needed to get comments from the governor. And I said, well, how do I do that? And my editor was a fellow named Russell Dushinsky, who you might know, some of you might have known. He said, well, call him. So I did. I called him at the old, which wasn't old then, but the governor's house. And Grace Link answered the phone. I told her who I was, and I'd like to talk to the governor. I could hear her say, "Hey, Art, it's Jack from Devil's Lake." And I'd met him a couple of times, and he was so astute, he remembered that my wife was from a ranching family in western North Dakota. I'd met him just a couple of times at various events. He comes to the phone. We do our business. I get a couple of quotes, hang up, and go to write my story. Years later, and now today, I think about that and how remarkable it seemed to be at the time, and it was. Most states weren't like that. And how remarkable it is in light of the changes that we see now. Try to call the governor today.
Mike.
Well, I'm so pleased to be invited because it's an opportunity for me to rip Jack a little bit. Art Link called me. And here's how it happened. It was very early in the new year of 1975, I think, and the phone rang at about 1:30, 2 o'clock in the morning. It was New Year's Day. I'd been in bed for a few minutes. I probably wasn't really coherent, but the governor said to me, "Jim," he always called me Jim, he never remembered my name in all of the years that we spent together, he said, you were asking me a question this afternoon, and I thought I should call you and give you a little more information." And I thought, this is North Dakota. And it's Art Link, because he would naturally think that everybody had been in bed since 9 p.m. I will say just a couple of things very briefly. It's fine to celebrate sunshine in North Dakota, but let me tell you, the clouds are moving in. The last legislature did some serious damage to open meetings laws. The one that's most significant to me is that it passed a law saying that no application records, no job, no application for any job would be public until it was down to 3 finalists. So that means if you're hiring a janitor at the Halliday School District, you're not going to know who the applicants are until the 3 fellows at the corner of the bar downtown who applied are finally revealed. The other, you know, there is going on now a fairly serious effort to cut back on publication of public records in North Dakota on the grounds that it can be done more easily online, and it will save money. You always want to go back to legislative intent. You know, the constitutional originalists talk about what was the intent of the founders. The intent of the people who passed these publication laws was to make it easy for people to get a hold of information. You don't make it easy by cutting back on the number of places put information. You put it in as many places as you can. And that ought to include the newspapers. And finally, I will say that I have known Doug Burgum for a very long time, and I have a fair amount of affection and respect for him. But he is, without question, the least accessible governor of North Dakota that I've worked with, and I know all of them since John Davis.
Amy.
Well, I've been reporting on government for about 15 years in North Dakota, and there's only one meeting that I've ever been kicked out of, and it was actually on the Minnesota side of the river. I was at a search committee meeting for a president, and I went to it just assuming it was open because the NDSU version of that would have been open, and someone comes up to me and asks who I was and asks me to leave. And so I think it's a good thing, I guess, for North Dakota that that's never happened to me in North Dakota. But today, because of the law that Mike was just talking about, I would be asked to leave that same meeting on the North Dakota side of the river. So I do think, you know, there has been a little bit of a tightening of access to government, but we still enjoy, I think, more access and more openness in North Dakota.
And you know, I see the biggest change on the local level as far as accessibility. The local elected officials at the county, city, and school board level appear less aware these days about what their responsibilities are in regard to opening meetings and giving proper notice. Our newspaper, both in Crosby and Tioga, on many occasions in the almost 20 years that I've been there have had to ask for attorney general's opinions, and we usually are upheld that we're viewing it correctly and that they aren't. Some of it is just a lack of knowledge, but some of it isn't. And I see more and more public officials these days on the local level who don't feel a particular duty to speak to the public or to speak to the press who is advocating on the public's
behalf. They can use their Facebook page or some other way of doing it. We've got all these different right. ways of getting information, and some of these are echo chambers, unfortunately.
And so it's frustrating that, you know, we're actually there to help and assist them get their message out. I think in the fake news era that we are in, the sometimes disparaging comments that are made about the national press impacts how people react to journalists today. And it's just very sad because we're there to help and advocate for them, and they don't necessarily see us that way.
I think there's a misperception sometimes about what it is a journalist is, and the fact that there are ethical guidelines for the proper practice of this profession. That isn't to say that these guidelines aren't occasionally abrogated, but that there are really rules of the road for the people who do this. Jack, you've made many requests for information for the forum to the state.
Forum Communications overall, because it has the resources, has fought this fight a lot, put a lot of money into it, and it gets expensive when you do that. Mostly successful, not always. Part of, I think, of what the problem is with the transparency of government, with the ability of the average citizen to know what's going on in government, is that the resources of the media, not only in North Dakota but in other places, but in North Dakota is what we know, those resources have been significantly reduced.
Yes.
There are fewer of us doing what we used to do in newsrooms like the Heralds and the Tribunes, and ours in Fargo at the Forum were much larger. In the meantime, the state's grown. Our communities in most places in the state have grown. There's much more going on. We do not have the horses to do the job we used to do. When I think of, and Dave could speak to this better than I, when I think of the size of the Capitol Press Corps out here in Bismarck just, 10, 15, 20 years ago compared to what it is now, and the experience that was part of that press corps, I think of some of the people who were involved in the Associated Press, the Bismarck Tribune, our bureau, the Herald, the Minot News, the Minot Daily News had people coming down here to cover the Capitol, cover the legislature. I think that not only are there fewer people covering state government and the larger local governments, the depth of their experience in government, the understanding of how government works, where the bodies are buried, as they say, there are fewer and fewer of those people. Dave is one of the last standing, and he knows as much about what goes on in the Capitol and state government than any working reporter today. There just aren't enough Daves doing the job across the state.
I'd warn you of one other trend in North Dakota. There is a serious effort going on to sharply curtail the rights of initiative and referendum.
That's right, yes.
In the state. Those were hard won and took quite a lot of courage on the part of people who brought them to us. So I think we need to be alert to what the political system is doing that makes it more difficult for individual citizens or even citizens en masse to have, you know, an effective involvement in government. I think the change from 2-year to 4-year terms for members of the House of Representatives was a catastrophic mistake. Just as the and for this reason, it takes away the people's right to change their minds. So that you know you can't sweep the bums out at any one point anymore. The other big mistake that was made, and this is a mistake that the people made because they approved this in a constitutional amendment, was changing the terms on the Board of Higher Education from 7 years, one term only. I believe in all the history of the board, there's only been one person who was reappointed to a 7-year term. And that person was ill and wasn't expected to live very long. So we went from 7 years, one term, to 2 terms, reappointment possible. And frankly, I've been around a long time, quality of the Board of Higher Education has declined. And the decline, I think, is linked to that. You know, it seems like an innocent and maybe even subtle change, but those things do matter. And I think that if we're interested in good government, we need to be alert to those kinds of manipulations in the structure of the government that we've built and that we've made work in the state.
I have one quick inside baseball thing that I've seen a little bit of erosion. When I first started covering the legislature, party caucuses were held on site at the Capitol. Now they not only can hold what they call, quote, social caucuses, end quote, off-site, but often those are where a lot of discussion happens. They may not take votes, but they get a sense of the caucus. And we're not allowed to be there. Sometimes we show up and sometimes we're asked to leave, but they won't tell you where it is. Often they come back the next day and things have changed. So that is one small thing that I've seen.
Amy, anything?
That brings up an important point, because when I hear people complain about a government agency, it's not usually that they don't like the decision, it's that they don't like the process, or they feel like something was shady or something was secretive. And I think just the perception that people have is really important, to have it out in the sunlight, have the transparency. And even if you don't like the outcome, you know, I think you have more buy-in to the ultimate decision.
You've been listening to a panel of journalists discussing North Dakota government at the Good Government Summit Sunday afternoon in Bismarck. We'll hear more from the panel in a moment.
It's time to celebrate. Two decades ago, the historic Downtown Empire Movie Theater in Grand Forks was renovated into the beautiful Empire Arts Center, loved by the greater Grand Forks community today. The 20th Anniversary Celebration Week, April 21st through 27th, will feature concerts, movies, and even an open mic night. And, of course, the famous Empire popcorn will be served all week long. Details at 701-746-5500 or empireartcenter.com.
You're listening to Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton. Yesterday, I moderated a panel discussion with journalists talking about their experiences covering North Dakota government. Part of the discussion focused on ethics and whether the state should have an ethics commission to review questionable actions by government leaders. The panelists were Prairie Public's Dave Thompson, Jack Zaleski with The Forum, Mike Jacobs with the Grand Forks Herald, Amy Dalrymple with the Bismarck Tribune, and Cecile Wehrman with Journal Publishing.
There's an effort out there now across the state to get petitions out for an amendment to the state constitution that would require an ethics panel, a commission or committee. This is an issue that has come up several times, one of those chestnut questions that gets asked every other year or so. Why isn't there an ethics panel overseeing the North Dakota legislature? What is the perception that you have working with the legislature about this issue?
The perception that I have is that legislators like to say we're citizen legislators, we're not full-time people, we understand ethics, we don't need an ethics commission. You know, if you're talking about, just the simple thing of optics, that doesn't look good for optics, that you don't have some kind of overseeing thing, some place where you can go and actually say, hey, there's been this problem, and you can make a complaint to somebody. You really can't unless you go to a majority leader, I guess, or maybe to the legislative council.
There are a couple of ethics proposals out there, I guess, circulating. I've been paying a lot of attention to it. I was early on participating in one of the groups that was proposing to do this, and kind of backed away because I'm still working as a columnist. One of the proposals I saw had a very large appropriation attached to it. I don't know if that's still there. Someone would be that's gone. All right, because that was a death. That was a killer. That was a poison pill. It was a bad idea. Spinning off what Dave said, that legislators say we don't need this kind of oversight or self-policing, however you want to look at it. Because legislators say we only meet, you know, we're citizen legislatures, legislators, and we meet once every 2 years. But if you sit down and talk with your individual legislator, he or she will tell you that it's become a full-time job. We've got committee meetings. We're going to board meetings. We're going to the Capitol. We're traveling to the Capitol for all sorts of things. So while they like to make the case that they're citizen legislators, and they are, they only meet, you know, officially 80 days. So I guess they meet the technical definition of that. They go home in what they call the real world. On the other hand, they like to tell you how much they work during the interim. So you can't have it both ways, especially true of the leadership and the committee chairman and women. So they can't have it both ways. Now, The other side of this is that we have a sense in North Dakota, and I think it's a legitimate sense in North Dakota, that our legislature and our state government and to most cases our local governments are peopled by honest folks, people we know mostly, even in a city like Fargo. It's not hard to get to know the people who represent us on the city commission, for example, or our legislators from Fargo, many of whom you know. So we like to believe, and I think we can believe to some extent, that these are honest people who are not obviously in the legislature to enrich themselves. Until you begin to look behind what they do in the real world, and then you begin to see, if not a conflict of interest, an appearance of conflicts of interest. The committee chair deals with oil taxes, for example, who happens to also own an oil services field company. I don't know. On the other hand, if you're from a small town and you serve, say, on a number of different civic boards, you're a legislator, say you serve on the board of directors of your nursing home, which is common among legislators and, you know, people in communities who want to work for the communities. And you go to the legislature and you're working for some sort of legislation that has to do with nursing homes, funding for nursing homes, funding for in-home care, some sort of tax break for nursing homes. Is that inherently a conflict? I don't know. I don't know how you work on that one. Maybe an ethics commission of some sort, and I don't know what the structure would be a place for those kinds of things to be looked at. And then I don't know what you do. Kick a legislator out? Well, no, I don't know what you do. Anyway, it's easy for people to say, we need an ethics commission with the assumption that they're all corrupt. Of course they're not. And it's also easy to say we don't need an ethics commission because they're all as honest as the driven snow, even when the snow is full of snert. So I don't know. I don't have a complete answer to this. You know, I'm sure Mike does.
after we had our meeting in Grand Forks, Prairie Public did a Main Street about the meeting, and this question came up. And I said that I was for an ethics commission for the following reason. It makes journalism easier, because it creates a place where records are kept and can be examined. It used to be that legislators would stand up and declare a conflict before they voted on a piece of legislation. Bob Melland, who was a Republican leader in the state Senate, got up frequently because he was a man of many commercial interests, other kinds of interests as well, but the commercial interests were the ones that he admitted to. Your legislators don't do that as a matter of course. Even a person who is only a little bit acquainted knows that the majority leader in the state house, for example, has real estate interests and building interests in Fargo and consistently votes in them. In Grand Forks, the state senator is a major recipient of architectural awards from the state. You know, we know that.
The governor builds things.
Governor builds things. And the law does have an impact on those things. But just to return to my earlier point, the best ethics commission is an instant election. The first year I covered the North Dakota legislature, I wrote a column afterwards about ways to improve the legislature. This was really arrogant of me. One session, a guy with a journalism degree from the University of North Dakota, actually it's a philosophy and religion degree from the University of North Dakota, presumes to say that the legislature can be improved. But my suggestion was the election ought to be held immediately after the session adjourns because people's memories are fresh. I've gotten ensnared in academia, and my friend Brad Rehnquist, who is a geographer, is interested in the phenomenon of the corporate farming ban in North Dakota, and we've been talking about this off and on. And he asked me to explain to him how it can be that legislators can pass a repeal or an amendment to the corporation farming bill without consequence. You know, it never comes back to bite them in the election. The voters turn it down by, you know, one of the largest margins ever in a referendum election in the state's history, close to 80%. And the people who introduce and support this change are not punished at the ballot box. It's because nobody remembers. It doesn't make any difference how you feel about the corporation farming bill. It's true about other bills as well. People simply don't remember. So it would be a good thing. A good reform would be that the legislature adjourns on, let's say, late April. June 1st would be a good election date.
You know,
my other suggestion in that column, by the way, was to open the blinds in the House of Representatives chamber and let the sun in.
That was a media panel talking about their role in covering governmental affairs as part of Sunday's Good Government Summit in Bismarck. We'll have more of the discussion after the news with Todd.
Thanks, Doug. Nearly a year and a half after ground was broken, construction on Fargo's new City Hall is wrapping up.
The contractors will be done the end of the month, believe it or not, within a couple of week window there. But we expect to get the keys turned over end of April, early part of May. And so that's good news.
City Administrator Briss Grubb says the change orders increase the cost to the low bid of the $22.5 million by about 3%, which he says is reasonable considering the project size. Much of that was attributed to a city commission decision to install larger windows. Grubb says it will take another 2 months to complete fit-up of offices and IT.
By about mid-July is when we expect to start the move. We expect that will likely take another 30 days. So mid-July to, let's call it, mid-August, mid to latter part of August, we'll be open for business.
The current City Hall, with 24,000 square feet of office space, will be demolished once the move is complete to the new building next door. That should be sometime in October. The new City Hall has 94,000 square feet of office space, along with underground parking and mechanical space. More than 200 million eggs from North Carolina farm have been recalled because of possible salmonella contamination. Iris Public Media's Esther Hornig has more.
A notice posted on the Food and Drug Administration website says the eggs were shipped to restaurants and grocery stores in 9 states, including Colorado. The salmonella bacteria causes nausea, diarrhea, and in rare cases, death. The eggs came from a farm in Hyde County, North Carolina, that's owned by the Indiana-based company Rose Acre Farms. The eggs are sold in Food Lion and Walmart stores and served at Waffle House restaurants. 22 illnesses have been reported. In a statement, the company said the Hyde County farm has never had a recall or serious safety violation. And, quote, "We look forward to getting the Hyde County farm back in operation as soon as possible." Esther Honig, Harvest Public Media.
And the U.S. Supreme Court will be hearing a case Tuesday that could force internet retailers to start collecting state sales taxes. The case comes from South Dakota. It attempts to reverse an earlier decision in the Quill case from North Dakota. Quill sold office supplies through catalogs. The high court would not allow North Dakota and other states to require the collection of sales taxes from retailers that don't have a physical presence in that state. From the Prairie Public Newsroom, I'm Todd McDonald.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton. Yesterday, I moderated a panel discussion for the Good Government Summit at the North Dakota Heritage Center in Bismarck. The panel included journalists Amy Dalrymple, Cecile Wehrman, Jack Zaleski, Mike Jacobs, and our Dave Thompson. Cecile picked up the discussion about ethics in government.
There's been a couple of instances in my reporting career that I can think of on a local basis where a sheriff or a president of an authority, say an airport authority, was engaged in some illegal activity and actually under indictment. And, you know, when that happens, when somebody does do something wrong in North Dakota, it's not easy to get them out of office. it's really quite difficult. And in one of the cases, I remember the governor had some mechanism to go ahead and deal with it, and for whatever reason chose not to. So when somebody does do something wrong, I think we definitely could have some improvement in how we handle that. And so perhaps an ethics commission would have some mechanisms in place to help with that.
Would it be unethical for the Colony Commission chairman to pave the road to his farm? Not saying it's ever happened, of course.
But you point out, that's a good point, though. I mean, we have to wear so many hats in small communities. The ability to remain without any conflict of interest is pretty tough. But again, getting back to what Thomas Jefferson said about, you know, always doing the best things that you can and not just trusting yourself and power. I mean, you really have to weigh carefully whether it's for the good of all and not just for the good of you, and solicit input from other people in the community.
Full disclosure requires me to admit that I live in rural Grand Forks County and that the road to my place is paved. The county commission did not pave it for me, however. I bought the place after they had paved the road.
You know, somebody once pointed out to me that North Dakota, with, you know, 750,000 population, we talk about the government as the legislature and the executive offices here in Bismarck, but the state has boards after boards after boards after boards, water boards, township boards, county boards, all kinds of variations, professional boards. So the government here is wide and actually pretty deep. Chances are you know somebody who performs a public function.
Close to impossible not to.
Yeah.
One of the things that Lloyd Amdahl did in his political science classes at UND was have us calculate how many public boards there were. We got to pick a county, and in Nelson County, which is the one that I picked because it was close by, Grand Forks, and something like out of a population of 1,500 people, maybe 2,000, something like 300-400 of them had actual public positions. And across the state, I think Lloyd always said, and I think this is true still, North Dakota has the highest percentage of its population involved in public boards of one kind or another than any other state. One of my favorite legislative stories was the fight in the 1977 session, not over the coal severance tax, but between the cosmetologists and the people who use depilating creams to manage unsightly body hair. It was quite a fight. There are two separate boards. My point is there are two separate boards that govern, or were at that time, two separate boards that govern these two different functions.
Right. Yeah, that was a hairy one, Mike. So. When I was speaking about the press the other day, and Mike made the point, we're not here to talk about our roles. What I probably a little clumsily was trying to get to was that good government requires the sunshine we talked about, whether it's in the House chamber or in what we do as journalists, or supposed to do as journalists. When we don't have as many people carrying the light, government tends to do bad things. Not because they want to, because it's the nature of the beast. You know, not because they're evil, but it's easier to do the people's work behind closed doors than it is with the people watching. We are supposed to be the watchers. If there are fewer and fewer watchers who know what to look for, then government tends to do bad things. And it's not partisan. It's the nature of, God, I have to deal with this character from my hometown. Let's close the door. And so I think that happens. So again, I come back to the fact that some of the oversight that the press is supposed to provide and did provide for generations here, and I believe, and I don't think this is looking through older eyes here. I think it's an actual, it can be measured, that fewer lights are being shown into the halls of government, into the boards, into the various boards, into the school boards. You look at a city like Fargo, which has grown and has more and more and more and more going on all the time, several school boards, several art boards, several city governments. If you don't have the resources to to look at what they're doing, to report about what they're doing, tell the people what they're doing, then they don't know what they're doing. That tends to generate bad habits among people who hold office.
There's a new threat on the horizon, too. I just had my first experience with learning of a small town city council that was making decisions by text. So how do you begin to police that?
Don't they have to send it to everybody in town then?
Well,
sort of like a red alert.
But that's going to happen. That's going to happen. That's going to be, and it's very convenient. I mean, these people are working, they're busy. Being on a city council in a small town is a secondary job that doesn't pay well, and they got to get stuff done. But if they're going to do that a lot, I mean, that just is ripe for abuse.
Well, I used to work in higher education, and occasionally we'd get these information requests from the forum, occasionally, as a matter of fact. And we learned in that particular office, and I think it's a universal lesson in places that are susceptible to this, that you do not put anything in an email that you would not want everybody to see.
Well, Dean Brashani hasn't learned that lesson.
I was going to say the Board of Higher Education has several examples of that.
So we actually communicate a little differently than we used to. And the way information gets to reporters sometimes gets there differently than it used to.
You're listening to a media panel from yesterday's Good Government Summit in Bismarck. Coming up, a discussion about a particularly difficult story and a tough time for North Dakota leaders.
Support for Prairie Public is provided by the Bush Foundation, introducing the recipients of the 2018 Bush Fellowship. Learn more about the 2018 Bush Fellows at bushfoundation.org/fellows.
In our final segment from yesterday's Good Government Summit, the media panel with Amy Dalrymple, Cecile Wehrman, Dave Thompson, Mike Jacobs, and Jack Zaleski offer their observations about government actions and media coverage during the protests against the Dakota Access Pipeline.
Let's talk about a conflict, because sometimes a conflict can point to issues that need to be looked more closely at. And the conflict is one that's probably still, people still remember pretty vividly, and it might even be a little bit raw, but was the confrontation over the Dakota Access Pipeline, how it was covered. And even the reverberations today, the forum editorialized about this, the people who were covering it who were subjected to legal process.
Well, there is a symposium coming up at UND on the 19th, I think, that Mark Trahant is bringing together that's going to discuss exactly that question. I was startled on Saturday morning when I opened my email fairly early in the morning to have an angry note from a state legislator in Fargo responding to the story about this that was in the forum that morning. I think my name must have been mentioned as one of the people who's participating because this person had selected me to rant at, demanding essentially that the panel be expanded to include Paul Laney, the sheriff of Cass County. Yeah, the retiring sheriff of Cass County, who was the heat, so to speak, at the DAPL protests.
He was the face of the
He was the face of law enforcement. So that's still very raw, I think.
What did we learn?
One improvement that we've already seen is that now every time the Public Service Commission gets an application for a project, they now notify all of the tribes, not just the tribe that's nearby, but they notify all of them. And I think that's one step we've already seen that was a lesson learned from that situation to try to encourage more public participation earlier on.
Yeah. What I think we've learned is something that Doug Burgum taught us, which is that if you sit down and talk to people, you can actually accomplish something. The immediate reaction, and this was the reaction of the legislator who contacted me as well, was to militarize the situation. And that was the first impulse. And that turned out to be a dangerous reaction and potentially a fatal one. We escaped that. But it certainly did a great deal of damage to North Dakota's public image.
Well, two things. It was unprecedented in the state's history, this kind of a demonstration that started out relatively small and became international in scope, people coming from everywhere to be part of this, to
set up camp, along the river, along the side of the pipeline. And, of course, several were commuting up to Mandan and Bismarck every evening for a nice warm hotel room, but that's a whole different story that didn't get reported. Without making a judgment about who was right and who was wrong, this was an unprecedented event in the state's history, and the state did not handle it well. Not because they didn't want to handle it well, but because they were unprepared for something of this size. During this, I was still working at the Forum as the editorial page editor during this time, and we had, as it was still going on, we had into our editorial board Paul Laney, the head of the National Guard, and the head of the Highway Patrol, who were pretty much leading the response, and sat down with these three people and some of their associates to talk about, from their perspective, what was happening and what had happened. And unless they lied to us, which I just don't think they did, they found a situation which they indeed, as bad as it got, were able to keep the lid on to some degree. Now, the arrest of journalists is a different matter. There were some people who said, I'm a journalist, and, anyone can say that. But there were, and they might have been arrested. There were some people who were legitimate journalists. They were pointed out in that editorial, I think the Forum did this week, that were and had a record of reporting in various places on various events and were arrested for reasons that won't hold water when this all gets to court, but were put through the ringer on this. Now, this might have to do with the heat of the moment, the inexperience or the unable to distinguish between someone who's masquerading as a journalist and someone who is. That'll happen in these kinds of events. That went on, that's been going on for years. Secondly, or thirdly, I guess it would be, I was traveling in the East during this time and going to the various places that I frequent when I'm out there in New England, reading the papers and watching the news and being near a couple of well-known college campuses out there. And it was incredible how distorted, from our perspective, I think, the coverage was, how tilted, how skewed it was in favor of the Native position. It was amazing. I was surprised. This was being done by newspapers and broadcast outlets that don't have an agenda, that are well-respected broadcast and print outlets that have reputations as great publications and great stations. The skewing of the story was surprising. It was very surprising.
Just let's not let ourselves off the hook here.
No. That's not what I'm doing. I'm telling you what we saw.
The real problem here is that the state of North Dakota did not handle the permitting process properly. It was not open and above board about the permitting process. There were mistakes made, maybe because there was a cozy relationship with the oil industry, maybe not.
We're
talking about good government here, and the good government part of this is that we needed to have a more open, more engaged process from the beginning of this. And we needed to take time to listen to people who are citizens of this state, and not try to complain about the coverage of it afterwards.
And my contention is none of that would have mattered once this took off and once it took fire.
There were so many outside influences
but my point is we should be reporting and interjecting. It took off because we didn't handle it well. The way to deal with this sort of thing is not after the demonstrations have started. The way to deal with it is to come up with a process that people feel engaged in, that people feel is fair. And one of the ways that you do that is through an open and participatory process. And we didn't bother to do that. And so we reaped the whirlwind.
Right. And I think it's so interesting how these outside influences, a lot of them came through social media, through Facebook. And I know that you folks at Prairie Public are aware of Amy Sisk's picture from the DAPL protest.
Yes.
Being taken over by a Russian
appropriated
group, appropriated for a meme that took one side and distorted what the original photo was, didn't identify it. I mean, we're now ripe for meddling, even in a state like North Dakota. It's really something.
I was in Singapore just by coincidence visiting a couple of friends who teach in the American school there. I went to an afternoon gathering in Holland Village, which is a suburb, very laid-back place. And one of the people that was at that gathering had just returned from Standing Rock, where he wanted to bring blankets during the blizzard. So it was an international story.
Yes, sir.
And the state took it right on the chin.
Bottom line, I understand the pipeline is up and running. What happened?
Let's go to another issue here that this relates to, and that is what's a fact and what's context and what's happened to all of those things. We see some examples, maybe in North Dakota, but certainly in other places, of facts just being conveniently remembered or conveniently forgotten, and context being whatever the moment of the day is, as opposed to what's the history and where's this going if you follow a typical trajectory. So what's happened to the actual meat and potatoes of what it is we do? Facts.
There is the $64 million question, I believe. And in my estimation, what I have seen is that sometimes social media things are broadcast or written about without doing the due diligence of picking up the phone and checking the fact. Case in point, we are talking about good government, so a school board was involved in this, and not directly. But this was after one of the Dakota Access Pipeline news conferences in Mandan. The law enforcement was giving their spiel, and I was leaving, getting ready to come back. Amy was down at Standing Rock. Amy Sisk was down at Standing Rock, and I was coming back to Bismarck. And I happened to tune on one of our local AM radio stations that used to have a pretty good reputation for news. And he came on and said, "We have reports of shots being fired at Legacy High School. 3 students are dead, 17 are injured." And I thought, now what? So I called Bismarck Schools, got a hold of Renee Walker, and Renee said, "They're reporting what?" It was totally a social media hoax, and you have people who are taking things off social media, A, not attributing it to social media, B, saying, "We have learned." And I think that could be, you know, some of the ethical lapses that we're seeing in our business. There's an old saw that everybody on this panel has heard: if your mother says she loves you, check her sources.
We've got only a minute or so left.
Well, I'm the old guy. In a panel like this in Grand Forks, I called myself a contextualizer, and that's what I like to think I do. But I would just remind you, each and every one of you, that good government is your responsibility, and getting good information is your responsibility. You need to, the fancy word for this is curate. You need to curate your own sources. You need to be comfortable with the sources that you're looking at. If you're a seriously interested in public affairs, you ought to be looking at more than one point of view, and you ought to be making up your own mind. You ought not be calling up the newspaper to complain that they're not covering something. You ought not be blaming, you know, fake news on anybody else. I mean, you need to be in a position to make your own judgments about the information that you're consuming.
We'll end it with that. Amy Dalrymple, Mike Jacobs, Jack Zaleski, Dave Thompson, and Cecile Werman, thank you very much. And thank you. The Good Government Summit yesterday in Bismarck followed a series of meetings in communities across the state. People were invited to offer suggestions, and you can find out more at thinknd.org. The summit was made possible by ThinkND, the Northern Plains Ethics Institute, the North Dakota Humanities Council, and the Bush Foundation. And again, our panelists were Amy Dalrymple, Cecile Werman, Dave Thompson, Mike Jacobs, and Jack Zaleski. Dakota Datebook is next.
Arts programming on Prairie Public is supported in part by the North Dakota Council on the Arts, a state agency developing, promoting, and supporting the arts in North Dakota.
This is Dakota Datebook for April 16th. Johnson Nicias, born in 1850, played a number of roles in the final years of Dakota Territory. He was an attorney in Jamestown who served two terms on the Territorial Legislative Council, which included the last session at Yankton and the first one at Bismarck. In 1883, Nicias introduced the bill to incorporate the city of Jamestown, which passed up to Governor Nehemiah Ordway, who, for whatever reason, did not sign or veto the legislation. So Territorial Secretary James H. Teller affixed the territory's great seal to make the incorporation official. In 1883, after the legislature transferred part of Wells County to Foster County, Nicias helped a wealthy Dakota developer recover a number of townships back to Wells County in a border battle. That developer was Richard Sykes, who founded some early towns in what is now central North Dakota. He rewarded Nicias with a small house and lot in Jamestown. Nicias was also on the scene for legislative efforts to remove the territorial capital from Yankton, chairing a special committee to study a bill to place the capital in Huron. Nicias also had hopes that a town he platted in McHenry County could get a rail line. Scriptown was located near Velva. It was briefly the McHenry County seat, but Towner gained that distinction, no doubt in part because the railroad came to Towner, but not to Scriptown. Towner even gained the log cabins that had comprised Scriptown. On this date in 1889, Governor Arthur Millett appointed Johnson Nicias as the sixth and last Attorney General of Dakota Territory, an appointment that ended in just a matter of months as the territory gave way to statehood. And George F. Goodwin was elected as the state's first Attorney General. Nicias went on to become the U.S. Consul to Barranquilla, Colombia, under President Benjamin Harrison. In 1898, Nicias was elected mayor of Tacoma, Washington, serving one term. He died suddenly in 1901 in Honolulu, Hawaii. He was only 51 years old. Nicias Park in Jamestown is named for him. Today's Dakota Datebook was written by Jack Dura. I'm Merrill Pepcorn.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding from the North Dakota Humanities Council.
Tuesday on Main Street, Ted Quanrud was an early staff member on Prairie Public, and he worked on the air for more than three decades with us with shows like Sunday Serenade and A Little Night Music. Well, he's retired, and on Tuesday we'll visit about his radio career. And we'll share more from the Good Government Summit in Bismarck, which took place on Sunday. Humanities scholar Clay Jenkinson will talk about good government as Thomas Jefferson. We hope you can join us for Main Street on Tuesday. In the meantime, enjoy the rest of your day.